Well, welcome to Blind Faith, a podcast exploring God, or exploring thoughts about God and life in this world. I don't know why I didn't say that as clear, but we'll just leave it. It's okay to be a little clunky, a little bit. This is going to be our authenticity that I am...
keeping it real. Keeping it real.
So my name is Andy Ovi, and I'm a professor at Life Pacific University, and we're here doing this podcast. We have a couple others here.
Hi, my name is Paige Pester.
Hi, my name is Salma Kettner.
Do you guys want to introduce a little bit of who you are, not just your name?
Sure. I'm an adjunct professor here at Life Pacific University. I'm a wife and a mom and in full-time ministry.
Yes, I'm a student here at Life Pacific University. I'm a sophomore ministry major. I'm also our student body president. And then I'll just say it, I'm a daughter, I'm a friend, all the things that you are at 20 years old.
Oh my goodness. Why did I think you were 19? Did you just have a birthday?
I did, actually.
Happy birthday.
Last Monday.
Oh, well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Well, no way. No longer a teenager. You better start acting more mature.
Time to figure it all out.
No, that is what it feels like now.
Oh, man. Well, birthdays in college, that's its own experience. And I have so many stories. I guess that's just bringing me back to my time in college. Well, I started a little bit later after losing my eyesight, but I was here. And one of these stories that just I was remembering as we were coming in here to record, I was remembering this guy, Sheldon Koch, who would tell this story when he was a camp speaker at Camp Cedar Crest. But we were students together before he was the camp speaker, you know, that. Oh, and sometimes I always wanted to be the camp speaker, but I guess I ended up being the camp story a lot more often.
Aww.
as people thought my story was inspiring in ways. So, but this guy, Sheldon Koch, and who died tragically way too young a few years ago, but this guy that I went to school with did what we do as dudes who... go as long as we can without getting gas because money's tight or whatever. So we were driving somewhere in St. Dimas and we ran out of gas. And I'm like, okay, what do we do? And he's like, well, let's just push it. Like if we can get over the hill here, it'll just be downhill.
Yeah, just got to go up the hill.
And then we'll just coast downhill to the gas station. And so we're like, okay. And I'm thinking, how am I going to like, once it starts going, what, I'm not going to like run and jump in the car.
So figure it out as we go.
So I'm like, sure. And so we're getting behind and pushing and pushing, like, but he's pushing from his door to steer and I'm pushing from behind.
Oh no!
And we get over the hill. And I think he's not thinking through it all the way either. Like he's like probably realizing as we go.
Yeah. Like, wait.
but then it gets even more funny. So we're doing it and we do it. It's a slow, like, once you start going over the hill and it starts picking up speed, so I'm like quick and I jump on the back of the car and I'm sitting on the trunk of the car.
What?
As we're coasting that, and we're not going fast. It's not like a steep, we're in San Dimas. It's not, wherever we were, it wasn't a big hill, but we're coasting. And then we come to another, like to go back up a little bit and we're pushing and we're pushing. And suddenly, our friendly, officer comes over to us.
Oh.
Probably a little lights on or whatever. Like, what are you guys doing? Why is he on the back of the car?
Oh my.
And if I remember right, he then said he would push us to the gas station. And so aww, he kind of got nudged up behind us and pushed him up to the gas station.
That's nice. Yeah.
But the story that Sheldon would tell later is like, and then I'm trying to explain to this police officer why this, blind guy, my friend of mine, is like
sitting on the trunk of
why he's pushing my car. Like, and so this is this whole story that, I mean, then he used it as a illustration in a camp about gas and the spirit of God being the fuel for our life or whatever. But it's this hilarious story, especially as somebody who's a good storyteller like he was to tell a story. I'm just like, I'm often in these situations where people are like, now what do I do? I've got this situation. What do I do now?
Oh, that's funny. Now that you're like, I'm thinking about it as you're telling a story. And I feel like the only time I've ever been in a situation with a car that's run out of gas is with a guy.
That's so funny.
Why would you? Okay.
Yeah. Actually, that is. Yeah.
Let's not. I'm sure there's a woman who's run out of gas before.
I don't know.
That's not. I know. Okay. Only.
Wait, and, so you guys like willingly like got in the car, like knowing that you guys were probably going to run out of gas? Or was it like, oh, we just drove for too long and we didn't know what was...
Oh, I don't think we calculate like that well. Yeah. It's like for sure we got enough to make it back to the to gas. Like, and when I could drive, I ran out of gas a couple, maybe more than a couple times. My sister will still make fun of me that she had to come and... bring me a gas tank or a like a can of gas.
Oh my.
Why do we that?
I don't know.
Maybe this
we gotta study it.
Yeah, let's get some empirical research. I'm sure there's reasons that guys are beyond just that they're dumb. Because I will say guys are dumb.
Yeah. Well, it's just sometimes I feel like sometimes guys just don't think through those details of
And I'll just speak for myself. Yeah, it's okay if I run out of gas out in the country where I lived out in the country. I'll go knock on a stranger's door and ask if they got any gas. Like we'll solve it. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah,
no sweat.
And I for sure I do not want to put words in your mouths, but I'm sure ladies aren't going like if there's a lot of other thoughts. If I run out of gas, then what in the world could happen to me? Like, let's calculate this before I get in the car.
Yeah. No, 100%, definitely.
So I think we are more risk takers, which leads us to being dumb and all kinds of stuff. So that's probably part of the reason why life expectancy here for men is what it is, because it's not that we couldn't live longer. It's we make stupid
decisions. Yeah, you're here for a good time, decisions. Not a long time.
Yeah. That's one of the sayings of my favorite people I used to listen to on the radio is what he say. And maybe that's just a good way to kind of close this conversation. We're here for a good time and we're not here for a long time. And so hopefully these interviews aren't too long. And,
yes.
But we're here for a good time and these are meant to be stimulating, enriching and in the sense of good in that way that it's an enjoyable time engaging.
Yes.
And so this one we have what a cool I want to use the words that people in the entertainment podcast space say, oh, what a cool get, but that sounds so capitalist like capitalistic.
Got him.
Capitalist, but what a cool opportunity that we had Professor John Swinton join us even if it was digitally through the means that we had but from Aberdeen, Scotland. And What a engaging conversation we had with him. Let's go to it.
I was stuck in a labyrinth, called it a palace. He brought me out and gave me eyes to see. All my lonely towers, my misspent hours. You filled them with flowers in ways I can't.
Well, welcome to Blind Faith, as we explore thoughts about God and life in this world. This season, we are discussing disability theology, and we are so excited to have Professor Dr. John Swinton here with us on Zoom. But here we are with us in the conversation, and let me introduce him real quick, but first I just want to say thank you, Professor Swinton, for coming and being in this conversation with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, it's a real joy to us and me in particular. And so as I introduce you, let me just foreground some of the things that we want to highlight, and then I have a more organic personal story that I'd love to share. So Professor Swinton, one thing that he's been known for the past few years is his work on disability and time, Becoming a Friend of Time, the monograph that came out 2015, I believe. And that was just so meaningful to me. And we'll talk about that a little bit. But he's also written on a number of things related to dementia and also now working on a project on disability and mental health. He is a research professor at Aberdeen University in Scotland. He is editor of the series out of Baylor University Press on disability and religion and theology. And he is also working on a project with Ben Connor on Missing Voices in Disability Theology, and I hope we get to talk about that in this hour as well. So there's a little bit of the formality of what he's done, but I just really appreciate his character, his presence. And I got to meet you. I don't know how much you remember this. It was super meaningful to me, Professor Swinton, when you were on campus at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, just, I want to say 2 or 3 years ago, might have been 3 years ago. And this was with the Carl Henry Center for Theological Understanding and their, one of their big projects they were doing on creation and humanity. And you were there, and I didn't know, even though I was asking around, who's coming for this culmination of all this work they've been doing. And a number of people were coming that I was excited to either see again or maybe meet for the first time. And then somehow I didn't hear about your name. And I'm in that moment reading Becoming a Friend of Time, and so excited for just the language that was being put to disability theology. And that afternoon, I was reading in the morning, and that afternoon I was out with some students in my cohort, and my anthropology professor, director of our program, we're on our way back, and he's like, "Oh, I want you to meet somebody who's here from Scotland, and he's doing stuff with disability theology." And I'm like, "I know there's somebody from Scotland, from St. Andrews, but I don't think they do disability stuff there as much as this other place in Scotland I know about." And I was like, "Who is he talking about?" And I was so like, just trying to figure out who I'm going to meet, and why my professor is so excited for me to meet this person. And so he brings me on campus, and we walk over to the building where you guys are getting together, and my professor's bringing me, and I'm kind of hurried along, just excited to, well, maybe not even excited, just, okay, who is this person he's going to introduce me to? And I meet you, and I do not see, I'm not sure who I'm meeting, and you're very unassuming in that moment, and just very gracious, and shake my hand, and you say, "Hi, my name is," and I just couldn't hear it. It was quiet, and I think I heard John, but I couldn't hear anything beyond that. And I was like, say your name again. And then you said John Swinton, and I was like, wait a minute, the guy that I'm reading is actually here in this moment in front of me. And so we spoke for a brief moment, and I shared what I was working on, and a little bit stammering. I want to say I was speechless, but I'm sure I came up with some words to say. But I was like, I'm studying disability and mission, and you said to me, "Oh, good, we need that. We need that in the field. It's not being addressed." And so that really encouraged me. I will let you talk in just a second, but I was like, "Oh," I walked away to let you guys do the thing you're there for, and then I couldn't get back to my writing. I was like, "Oh, he's here, and they're gonna eat dinner in an hour. I need to craft a way to go interrupt him again and ask more questions while he's here in person." So that was my introduction to meet you, and it was such a lovely thing that then ended up being an hour and a half as I sat with you over dinner, and I somehow was able to join the dinner meeting, which I wasn't invited to, in an invite only thing. So there it was. It was a really lovely, beautiful thing. And the moment was a turning point in my dissertation towards bringing more narrative and biography and my story into my dissertation. You really helped encourage me in that, even if it was just through the conversation. It was like, I'm like, yes, I'm doing this the right way. I'm going the right way. So thank you for that. It's a little bit of a lengthy introduction, but thank you for that. And thank you for coming being with us.
That's great. It's good to see you again, Andy.
Yes. Well, we're so excited to have you on the podcast today. And so here on the podcast, our motto is all scholarship is biography. So this is personally one of my favorite questions to ask. Uh-huh. So I would love if you could answer how you came to study disability in the Bible and just what's the story behind that.
The story. Well, before I was an academic, I worked as a nurse for many years in the area of mental health and also in the area of intellectual disabilities. And I worked as a chaplain in the same areas for a little while as well. So all of my early years, I was with people who had disabilities or people who had mental health challenges, people who just saw the world in a different way. And so when I decided to leave, university. I thought originally I'd end up in chaplaincy because mm-hmm. that seemed like an obvious progression. But as soon as I got to university, I knew I wanted to study practical theology. And so I did. I got a job down in Glasgow, and then I got a job back up in Aberdeen. And it was just the obvious thing for me to begin to think about that. So I spent most of my life at that time working in these areas. So it made sense of asking the question, where's God in all of this? I don't understand this stuff theologically. And
Where's God in all this? And you said practical theology, so I want to interrupt just a moment. Because some people might say, oh, well, that's not real theology, right? Somebody might say that. Maybe you've heard that from somebody.
Well, only from people who believe in impractical theology.
That's what I was leading you to that. So, yeah. Could you speak a little on that? I know you have spoken on that. Yeah.
Well, practical theology is that dimension of theology that takes seriously systematic, historical, and biblical theology and the questions that they raise and ask, but then ask a different set of questions or a complementary set of questions. Not simply what has God done, but what is God doing now? What is God doing in the church? What is God doing in the world? And within that context, a good practical theologian will take a different set of questions to the tradition. So as a systematician, you might sit in your office and you might think about questions of the tradition that come from the tradition, the new questions, the new angles, although that's very important. As a practical theologian, we'll take questions that come from experience and come from the experience of the church or experience of the world and put them to the tradition. And so, for example, my work in dementia, a central question that comes out of advanced dementia is, what does it mean to know God when you've forgotten who God is?
Wow.
And that doesn't mean to say you have to change doctrine or change tradition, but the question itself reframes the kind of way in which you see things, understand things like providence, understand things like discipleship, and so on and so forth. Wow. And likewise, if you're thinking about people with intellectual disabilities, it's the same thing. What does it mean to love Jesus when you can never know Jesus in the way that the religious systems demand that you should do?
Wow.
And yet, God loves everybody and everybody's in God's image. So it's a fascinating question. They complexify things that seem to be ordinary.
Yeah, you said a couple of things there I'd love to just underline real quick. Or maybe say it again, how do you know God when you've forgotten God? And how do you know God when you don't know God in the way that some demand that you know God?
That's right.
Wow. I'm just really so much to think on there.
Yeah, and that's just so much to think about on there. And Dr. Opie had mentioned it, but you wrote a book about time and disability. So how did you come to write that book?
Well, one of the things that I learned through my nursing experience, and particularly with being with people with, say, profound and complex intellectual disabilities, is that speed doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because in order to get anywhere with anybody, you need to slow down and take time to be with the things and oftentimes the people that the world considers to be trivial. But the problem is that that's not how we think about time.
Yeah.
You know, you buy time, you use time, you waste time. Everything you do with your money in a capitalist society, you do with your time. And one of the things you have to do is be productive. Yeah. And you have to make the best of your time and produce the most things, which is why when people, for example, retire, somebody's retired, and that's what they say. You say, oh, I'm busier than ever. I'm thinking, why would you want to be busier than ever if you're retired? And the reason you're busier than ever is because busyness is a badge. Mm. It's something that you wear and you get your social value from.
Wow.
And so if somebody said to me, you know, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, oh, nothing. My boss would say, oh, you're wasting your time. And so on. But when I began to think about that in the context of that particular kind of experience, But also, when you take that back to scripture, you begin to see that that's not how God's time works.
Yeah.
We think of time as linear, moving from here to here to here. You always look over and put the person in front of your shoulder to get to the next thing.
Yeah.
But God's time is all over the place. Sometimes he's talking in the present. Sometimes it's past. Sometimes, you know, even on the cross, you see Jesus says to the robber beside him, "I'll see you tomorrow in mm-hmm. paradise."
Yeah.
And then Matthew 25 says, "The dead will be raised at the end of time." And you're thinking, how could that possibly be? Either it's now or then. But the reason that is that God just doesn't see time in that way. He sees time, all time at the same time, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So that was the motivation, only the beginning motivation for writing that book, and then everything else kind of came off the back of that.
Yeah. Well, there's so much I'd love to draw from that, the thoughts you brought out there. And one thing that was interesting to me as I came to the book, I had thoughts right away about Kasu Koyama and his work on 3 Mile an Hour God, and how God, and I think you even quoted that. So when I came to your writing and I'm reading how you connected things to things that were even in my mind about how God slowed down to walk at the pace of a human.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that was really meaningful to me, because I was in Thailand where he wrote that. And so I'm remembering how we would walk slow to not get sweaty. And so maybe 3 miles an hour in Thailand was a really particular pacing of life in the hot, humid climate. And to think, hey, God will slow down to walk where we are. And that's what discipleship is. As we disciple others, we walk with them, and we walk at the pace that they're walking, not expecting them to be at the pace we are. And then bringing this to the context of dementia. I'm reading this book as my dad's going through dementia, and wow. And I'm reading this book as I'm thinking about my own situation of things take longer for me to do because of blindness, and so there's just so many things to unpack there. And so I just love to open it to you to say something else that you want to on time.
Yeah, I mean, Kisuke Kiyama is interesting, because that idea of the speed of time. Yeah, I mean, the way that he frames it is that the average person walks at 3 miles an hour. So Jesus, who is God, walks at 3 miles an hour. So God, who is love, walks at 3 miles an hour. So love takes time. So it has a speed, and it has a time that's necessary in order to love. And I love that. But I was reading this book. It's called The Geography of Time. And it just explores time across cultures. Mm. And people walk faster in New York than they do in Guatemala.
Yeah. Right, right.
You're the fastest. Like. So the speed that you walk tells a lot about the culture that you're in, yeah, the culture you inhabit.
Yeah.
And within that context, also what your priorities are in terms of value, in terms of expectations, in terms of who you see. Because the faster you walk, the less people you see. And it's particularly when it comes to vulnerable people or people who move slowly, it's very, very easy just to walk past. That's just what we do. Yeah. You're constantly walking past people. And one of the marks of being an oppressed person is that everything and everybody just walks past you and doesn't really care. Like. And so I think finding time for the things that God finds time for is really fundamentally important for the world. And it's one of the big gifts that the gospel in principle brings to the world, is that sense that taking time for trivial things, in inverted commas, and discovering that they're actually wondrous and beautiful things.
Wow. And as you're saying this, I'm reminded of thoughts that I started putting together that I haven't fully articulated after reading your work, or maybe it was in the same time. I was reading Jesus and the Disinherited by Howard Thurman, and you just mentioned like how Jesus and the people who are oppressed and the vulnerable, like, are in relation to time. But that the Jesus and the Disinherited is as he also identified as one who is off in the ditch or thrown to the side, disinherited in society, and you paint that picture so well in your book of those with cognitive impairments and that need caretaking, people in these situations, and when time is the factor that we're looking at, the idea of if I'm giving my time then comes to money again, and I have to come back to even all those phrases you mentioned a moment ago, time, buying time, spending time. Yeah. In Wisconsin, the ATM machine, the teller machine, it was always interesting to me living in Illinois. My friends in Wisconsin, they'd call it the time machine. It was just the slang for them was we're going to the ATM machine to get money, but they called it the time machine. And so, we turn time into money and we value it in as a commodity. And what does that mean to somebody who doesn't move at the speed that I can move at, or I don't move at the speed others can move at? What are they contributing to society? Then is the question. I think you even I had the quote in my mind a day ago, but in a culture of efficiency, and we ask the question of what bodies are worthy of living.
Wow.
I think that's true. I mean, there's a really interesting experiment that was done in Princeton Theological Seminary many, many years ago. And it's called the Good Samaritan experiment, right? And so these trainee ministers and pastors were in class, and they had been taught on the Good Samaritan, and they'd be given the assignment of preaching in Princeton Chapel on the Good Samaritan. And there's quite a long and beautiful walk from the seminary to the chapel there. But some of the students were told that they were late for their appointment, so they kept going. And when you're going to the chapel, under a little bridge, there was somebody that was supposed to be there in some kind of distress.
Wow.
And the people that were late walked past them to get to the chapel.
Wow.
The people that weren't late stopped and helped them.
Wow.
So it's quite funny that they were going to the chapel to preach on the Good Samaritan. That's the irony of it. But the more tuned you are to time, the more your priorities shift and change. And very often, it's those things that are not particularly important to you at that moment in time that become put to one side. And very often, these things that are not particularly important to you are exactly the things that are important for God.
Wow.
Well, say that one more time.
Well, when you're
go on.
No, I won't, because I can only say things once.
Okay. Well, I just think we need to reflect on it. Things that are important to you are not necessarily the things that are important to God, and the things that are important to God we neglect as we are rushing in.
That's right. And then the problem then is you get tuned and you think that which is normal is abnormal. And so I did some work in Australia just before the pandemic. I was employed by an organization. Well, I was on sabbatical, so I wasn't employed, right? But doing some research for an organization there. And one of the things that they had noticed, it was an organization that focused on providing good dementia care for people with dementia. And one of the things that a Royal Commission had noticed was that there had been quite a lot of abuse in elderly care facilities. And they did an investigation, and one of the things that they noticed was that the reason that some of the abuse happened was not because people were really unpleasant. It's because they'd forgotten how to be present. Right, so you'd have two nurses or two carers in a room with a person with dementia. One would be talking on their phone or whatever it is, and they would ignore the person in between. And eventually that became the way what you do. So you had a culture where certain people become absent. And so when you don't notice that, bad practice becomes normal.
Wow.
And when bad practice becomes normal, that's when you have a real problem. And I think we have that problem at a cultural level just now. There's some things that are blatantly, obviously not good have become normalized.
That I think paints a picture of the Irving Goffman theory that gets used in some disability studies on sociology of passing. Like we just pass by people and then we don't even notice that they're there.
That's right.
And then he also uses the idea of stigma, which I think you bring out in some of the things you talk about. But wow, that is that is so profound. Such an insight there in that research you were doing.
Yeah, I feel like I'm just so like, I'm even just thinking, because I'm an undergraduate student, so obviously you have classes and then relationships, friendships, family, and then also on top of that, I'm our student government president, so that adds on a whole other thing. Right. But I always feel so convicted, even for me, like when I'm just walking around campus and there's so many times that the Holy Spirit has like had to tell me to slow down. My friends have a joke, I walk really fast because I'm short, so I'm like, I have to keep up with you guys somehow. But I've just been convicted so many times just to slow down, and I think as I'm going through like my undergraduate studies, it's always something that I'm thinking about, like how am I spending my time, because there's so many things I think that can just take away your time. But I feel like you've just said it perfectly, that a lot of times what matters to God isn't always our priority, and our priorities aren't always what matter to God. Like, you know, God is always going to care about if I'm in relationship with people, and if I'm checking in with people more than if I'm checking my email, which for me, I'm like, that's such a hard concept to kind of come to terms with. But yeah, I'm loving all your thoughts, and it definitely is making me think about how I'm just stewarding time, even for today. So
that's funny, because I like that a lot. But I often think, you know, when eventually we get to the pearly gates, the first question that St. Peter's not going to ask us is how well did you do in your career?
Wow! Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's so good.
Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that's not the case anyway.
So I don't need to pack my resume, my CV. Like, sure.
Well, maybe best to cover every option.
I think there's so many things. I'm curious as you reflected on the thoughts you brought out with that work, that monograph. I wonder if there's in your work you're doing now with disability and mental health. And I think that's such an important conversation piece, and that's what you were presenting on at the conference where I met you. What are some of the things that you're seeing connections to the mental health situation in the U.S.? I don't know if we're calling it currently calling it that, but the previous administration was saying it's a crisis, an emergency, especially with young people. What are there connections that you're seeing with the idea of time, or what other things are you seeing come out as you're doing work on mental health?
Well, I think it is a crisis, and I think certainly, I mean, I'm not American, so I don't know your system, but in our system here in the UK, there's a crisis because we just don't have enough services to deal with the level of need that there is then. But for me, I wonder why it is that we're having this crisis then. I think there's a number of different things. One of them is anxiety.
Yeah.
We live in a very anxious culture.
Yes.
And you can see it. I mean, if you think back to, you know, 2009 or whatever it was, when it was that big financial crisis.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody lost their money. And we discovered that money didn't exist. Right? The thing that we all were working for doesn't really exist. It's just a numbers that are passed around. And then you have COVID,
yeah,
and you discover that tiny little microbes can, you know, really stop the world, almost literally.
Yeah,
and you have no control over that. Then in Europe, you have war in Ukraine, a threat of nuclear war.
Yeah,
and so it goes on and on and on and on, and then and instability in politics. So people just absolutely have a generalized anxiety. I mean, I was watching the news the other day, and people were talking about, you know, young people just waking up in the morning feeling anxious just because of, you know, afraid to watch the news, and also anxious about ecological issues and so on and so forth. So there is a general anxiety, and there is a kind of cultural emphasis on success. You know, it's a kind of neoliberal politics that all of our countries in the West run on. Has certain criteria that you have to be autonomous, you have to be successful, you have to be powerful, and so, and within that system, those who don't succeed tend to be thought about as failures.
Wow.
And of course, many people don't succeed.
Yeah.
So I think there's all these cultural.
Yeah,
things.
Right. More people don't succeed than do. If we look at it that way, like.
Well, that's true, and it depends what you mean by success.
Because yeah, right.
I read an article in the New York Times recently, and it was talking about success anxiety.
Wow.
people are now becoming very successful in their whatever trade they're in, but they get to that stage and then they know that the only way is down. And so they're anxious and stressed because they're successful and because they know that they could lose it. So even if you succeed, you're in a situation of anxiety.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Wow. So I think all these things are part of what's going on. But also I think that people have just lost a general sense of living into a story.
Wow.
You know, we are individuals, we perceive ourselves as individuals, we perceive that the only story that matters is a story we tell about ourselves, and there's no coherent narrative that holds us all together. Once upon a time it might have been religion, but now there's all sorts of fragmented stories, which means it's difficult to work out who you are.
Wow.
So you have a lot of difficulties. But positively, I do think that this is an ideal time for the church to be the church. To recognize that, to help people to see the possibility of living into a different kind of story.
Wow.
I'm really fascinated by the idea of the still small voice, right? So I'm working on this idea just now, still small voice theology.
Wow.
That really takes seriously the small things, things that are so central to the Beatitudes. But sometimes we've forgotten in terms of our public theology. Wow. And I think returning to the Beatitude, returning to the friendships of Jesus, taking small things seriously, is a contribution that the church can make to the kind of, you know, anxious state that all of us share in. So positively, I think it's an opportunity to speak some helpful truths into a difficult situation.
I really, really like what you're saying. It's an opportunity for the church.
Yeah, that's good.
And I think there's so much there of when we consider the church as a contrast society in those terms. So often the church just tries to, the church often mirrors society and just tries to be a Christian version of what's going on, or to leverage things that are going on. But in this moment we live in, the church has something to offer. I've been wrestling with the idea of hope, and how do we communicate hope and hopefulness in a world that is hopeless, like as you painted the picture. But the church has an opportunity. And so how, and maybe then I'm asking the question is, how do we live into that? How do we more help, like, or what things are limiting us from actually being that to people?
Well, it's interesting. I think I'll come back to it, because I think this is important for disability. I listened to it. I went to a conference in London last year. And it was a historian called Tom Holland.
Oh, yeah, Tom Holland. Mm-hmm.
Dominion. And one of the things he said is Christians need to... Christians need to retain or regain their weirdness.
Oh, wow.
he said, anybody who thinks that in second century Mediterranean culture, somebody claiming to be God, being crucified and raised to the dead after three days was normal, is just wrong.
Yeah.
It's not that we become modern people and now it looks normal. It's always been weird, he said.
Yeah.
that's what makes it distinctive. And so the more we try to get away from that weirdness, the less distinctive we become. And part of that weirdness is, I think, taking seriously what Paul says about the body of Christ.
Wow.
It's the thing that's so powerful about the body of Christ is not its homogeneity, not that everybody's the same, it's that everybody's different.
Wow.
That's what marks the body of Christ, is difference. And I think that tells us a lot about how we can really think seriously and theologically about issues around disability and human difference.
Wow.
Because the body of Christ says, welcome in your difference and in your weirdness, whatever your weirdness may be. We're all in this together. None of us are models of what it means to be a human being. Paul says that everybody's sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, which is a great leveler. And if we grasp that weirdness, if we take seriously the body of Christ, the Beatitudes, the friendships of Jesus, then I think we've got something powerful to say.
Wow. Yeah, as a teenager, I loved being weird. Like I have my style; it's different. I don't want to fit in. There was a bit of me that wanted to be a nonconformist, but not the nonconformist that wears all the same things the other nonconformist wears. So I grew to like punk rock music and other things, but still, there was a part of me that just wanted to be different, but not. But that's not exactly what you're saying, but. But what I hear you saying,
nothing wrong with being a punk rocker.
No, I didn't. But what I hear you saying is that as Christians, we need to be more comfortable in our skin of that we are Christian, and that is something that is different in the world. And I think in the same way as you talk about the body of Christ, that we whoever we are in whatever body we're in, whatever particularities we have, our interests, our that we can fully embrace that as Jesus fully embraces us for in the person that we are, and then as the body together we are something, and as opposed to when you come back to the word autonomy you said before, like we're not all trying to achieve this singular personness.
No, that's a nice way of doing it.
Mm-hmm. That's really good. There's a lot I want to explore, but I want to hear some of what you're maybe shape a little bit of what you and Ben are working on. Help us grasp a little bit of missing voices, maybe in the particularities of how does a work like that come about? And also maybe because of the nature of our podcast, tell us why is that so important? Yeah. I know that in a book proposal and like the in the practicality of it, you have to do that to get the publisher to say, yes, this contributes something. But to us, the everyday person, why do we need to hear these missing voices? And I know there's a really good reason, so I'm looking forward to hearing it, but help us with that.
Well, kind of like the fact that you have to ask that question answers the question.
Well, I'm asking it because I want the audience to hear. Yes.
Well, the series, I mean, Ben and I have been friends for a long time, so it's always good to do things with Ben, and he's a kindred spirit because he has a real heart for people, and it's a pleasure to work with him. But the idea, it's a series, obviously, IVP series, that looks at missing voices, because if you think about, can we go back to what we were saying a few moments ago about the still small voice? If you think about that in terms of culture and politics, what small voices do you hear?
Wow.
Well, none right now, because it's the media amplifies the loudest and the most annoying and the most annoying voices.
So. Exactly. And so you could argue, in other words, there's a whole raft of voices that are never heard because other voices are profound and loud. And so at least part of the motivation for this is to become a vehicle that can enable people whose voices are not normally heard to have a strong position in the theological conversation around disability. Yeah. And it's not a matter of me and Ben talking for people. That's the exact opposite.
Yeah. Can I ask you to, as I'm hearing you, and I heard a little bit of Ben elsewise, but I don't remember where I heard this, or maybe this is criticizing Ben a little bit, but the word amplify, and this isn't about this in particular, but we hear this word in terms of global theology, world Christianity too. Like some people will say, oh, there's voices that are missing in our theological education and let's amplify them. And my response would be like, well, their voices are there. It's not that they need amplification. The God is speaking through them and something is happening already. It's just for whatever reason, it's not that they need amplification. There's good something point. Else drowning them out. So maybe expound on what you were saying. I wanted to interrupt a little bit, but I know you're saying something that I wanted to draw out a little more.
No, that's not great. To be honest with you, I hadn't thought about that as an analogy. Because amplifying a voice suggests that you just do the same as the loud voice, except a bit louder. So you're back into exactly the same dynamics. So perhaps it's creating a space where people can listen to voices that are not normally heard. Because I think the you're right. The idea of amplifying there's a challenge in that because it's almost conformist. But the idea of helping people to slow down and listen to different voices, I think, is what.
But
in order for that to happen, people have to be noticed. And very often, people who are not loud and rambunctious. Is this such a word as rambunctious?
Rambunctious, yeah.
Yeah.
I've never used that word in my life. It's fantastic. I'm a new man now. Rambunctious. Anyway, those who are quiet. No, I forgot about what I was saying. Where was I? Tell me where I was.
We would slow down to notice voices that we don't notice because they're not the ones that grab attention, like whether it's social media influencer or the politician getting the soundbite on TV that know how to troll the media. But we don't stop to hear the voices of one sweet and kind people just in general. But we don't stop to hear the voices of those who we neglect in society.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's what the series tries to do, is to give people a platform, give people a space where they can articulate themselves in a way that can enlighten the rest of us in important ways.
That's awesome.
And then maybe this is getting more in the weeds than maybe some who are listening would care about. What is the process of how do you identify who is being included in this, and how do you, like you were saying, you're not just amplifying, you're not speaking for them, but so how is the process of, is this an edited volume, I guess, maybe, or is this what is the process of something like that?
Well, it's an IVP series, and so people from various perspectives with various kinds of interests and experience and disability are writing books in the series.
Wow.
So to my knowledge, I don't think any of them are edited texts.
Okay.
But Ben and I are working on the text together in conversation with a variety of people with different experiences.
Oh, so you're co-authoring and you're bringing the things that you are hearing as you interview others and bringing together.
Kind of a
reflection, allowing their reflection on theology, on who God is, how God is in the moment with them, or in the, and bringing that to us, so we can wrestle with it as well. Oh, wow. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, I've got lots of questions, but I want to ask if Salma's got any other questions or things before I circle back to something that's been in my mind for a minute.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I really have any more questions. I feel like I already have so much to think of. But I just think it's really cool, just the work that you guys are doing, especially with stories. I know something that we talk about a lot on this podcast is just the importance of hearing people's stories. And so it's been super cool to hear your story, but also just cool to hear how you're kind of giving that space for other people to share their stories. Yeah. And I'm always excited to read stories and just to learn about people through their experience. So, yeah.
That's great.
Well, I do want to circle back to some of the stuff we've touched on with time and in a culture like the United States. You mentioned New York. We're in LA, the Southern California area.
Yeah.
People move at such a pace here. I mean, just in the practicality, my wife and I are always talking about this idea of how fast people are going, not just in traffic, but how fast they're like just the pace of life and to keep up. It's all, you know, that whole thing. And, putting our kids in or not putting them in activities and we were just even addressing the thing of the over the past couple of generations how more and more two income families, and so then the kids just aren't out playing in the neighborhood because they're all in organized activities because that's how they can justify, and this is my hypothesis, how parents can justify, okay, I'll be with my kids at this because I have to take them to this organized activity. We don't have free play the same as when I was growing up or something. And so the time just dictates the way we go. And where's the time to pause and reflect? Where's the time to hear God in the midst of the business? Where's the time for, but it also speaks to that trying to just keep up with success or whatever. So I'm curious some more of your reflection on that idea of how we move.
So I think in terms of what we can do to move into that mode of slowing down is really to take Sabbath seriously.
Wow, that's good.
So, you know, if you think about what God says when he gets Sabbath, he says, take a break.
Yeah.
Step outside, think about me, and then get on with your life for the rest of that time. Mm-hmm. And that's what really Sabbath does is it breaks linear time.
Wow.
It breaks the daily drudge that we go through and says there's something different, there's something special, there's something going on here that you won't notice unless you step into this Sabbath.
Wow.
Now, of course, most of us are probably too busy in some senses to take a Sabbath in the sense of that whole day and do your thing like. But none of us are too busy to take what you might call Sabbath moments.
Wow.
But even in your busiest time, step outside, literally physically step outside of the space that you're in, recalibrate, think who God is, remember God, and go back in. And you'll actually, whatever you're doing, you'll do it better because your perspective will have changed.
Wow.
When you're really busy and stuff, you don't see a lot of things. Lose your perspective, but take a Sabbath moment and step back in, and then everything changes.
Wow,
that's good.
And I don't know if I can transition to this as well as I'm wanting to in my mind. I've been hesitant to ask this question as we've been talking about the culture of efficiency that I highlighted that quote earlier, but it just seems all the more this many years after you wrote that work that. At least in the U.S., I'm sure the U.K. and Europe has similar sensibilities, but the U.S. and so this might be a really rough transition of talking about Sabbath to then in the moment we're in. I hesitate on a podcast like this that's meant to be evergreen or not necessarily talking about the current thing in the world going on, but our current Secretary of Health and Human Services, I won't name his name, but he's in the news a lot because he speaks a lot. He's one of those loud voices, and he's been on a thing about autism for a long time, but he was recently in the news and getting a lot of feedback from what he was saying about, well, people with autism, they don't play Little League. They don't blah, blah, blah this, and they don't participate in this, and they don't, and he was saying a lot of things that I think had a crossover to some of the criticism you have on culture of efficiency and what that means about who is worthy to live in this society. And so he was saying those things, and right away, it makes people like myself and others go, well, who is okay to be in this country then? Like what things do I have to participate in to be human enough for this person? So I don't know that you're reading that story and that's okay if you're not, but you've spoken a lot or written a lot.
I know the story.
Yeah.
But this is how I would think about it. Like, the obvious thing is that none of these things define your humanness. You're not defined by what you don't do. You're defined by who you are, and who you are is loved by God. So at that level, you know, I don't really see... I certainly don't agree with that. But at a deeper theological level, think about it like this. In the book of Genesis, there's two creation stories.
Wow.
The first creation story is God creates the world and gives Adam dominion over the world to crush it down, to hold it in this place. And we seem to be very good at that, like crushing down and holding it in place. Like. But the second creation story is different. The second creation story says Adam's told to care and tend for the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
So care is a primal responsibility that God has given to human beings to care and tend for the world. Yeah. Of course, we are part of creation, so that's to care and tend for us now. Now, the necessary corollary of care is to be cared for. So to be cared for is part of what it means to be a human being. To be cared for is part of what that creation dynamic, that gift that God gives to Adam to care for the world. So to be cared for is not something to be ashamed of. It's something that God says, yes, that's what human beings are supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
And so if you come to a time in your life, whether it's through accident or dementia or whatever it is, where all that you can do is be cared for, that's fine, because all you're doing is living into an aspect of humanness that culture's forgotten about.
Wow.
So when I hear things like that, I think it's just a theological mistake and a cultural mistake.
Wow,
that is, I think that, along with a number of the profound things we've heard in this hour, it's just, I think that's a really wonderful way to draw us back to creation and purpose and design and thank you so much. We've touched on so many things,
yes.
From Sabbath moments to that we often care about the things that God doesn't, or the things we care about are the opposite of what God cares about, and walking at the pace that we walk at, that God would love at that speed. So many things that you brought up. So I just really thank you for coming and being with us in this conversation. I think you've helped us and helped those that are listening to think more carefully about what it means to be human and what it means to know God.
Yes.
Thank you for the invitation. It's been a pleasure to speak to you both.
Yes, thank you so much. That was such a great conversation. And I know that all throughout the conversation, we were just talking about how there were so many even just like one-liners that you could really just sit and just chew on. But I think for me,
that he was so funny when I was like, can you say that again? He's like, nope. I said it once.
He's saving
one. Yes, that was great. That was probably one of my top 10 moments of that interview.
So I was like, oh, I'm glad you did that to me. I was trying to tell you to do something and you're like, nope.
I know, which even... Yeah, but I think something that was just like a constant theme was just how we were talking so much about time and how a lot of times what we prioritize isn't often what God would prioritize for us to use our time with. And I know that just really like hit home for me, especially as a college student, that I definitely could make a whole list of these are all the things that I'm busy with. I'm busy. But really, I know I'm just sitting on like, am I taking time for what truly does matter? Am I taking time for people? So yeah, those are just kind of my thoughts. That's what's going through my head right now.
and just so much in time management is right in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot there.
Yeah, and how he ties it back to even like a Sabbath and how maybe not everybody can, have, a whole day, but even moments. And I mean, we certainly need more than moments, but
we do. But even if we have more moments daily, that can lead into finding ways to have more longer moments,
right?
Weekly and then monthly and even yearly. And I keep trying to get to this yearly rhythm where I have a retreat, a Sabbath type retreat. Yeah. And so the whole idea of Sabbath was meant to have these rhythms within the day, the week, the year, and we can barely even do the weekly as Americans. So, that's moments of Sabbath really jumped out at me too. That was good because I have students ask, "What professor? How do I do Sabbath?"
Yeah.
No, for sure. And I think even like as a student, I took spiritual disciplines last semester, and that was a really big thing that we talked about was Sabbath. I remember all my friends and I just saying like, we don't have time for a Sabbath. Like, we have assignments, we have to do all these things. But like, really, like when I think about it, like if I'm not making time for God, then I guess even like in how I relate to others, like why would I make time for others? Why would I make time for the person that's maybe unseen or unheard? And so, I think I just feel convicted in that area right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sabbath is one of those that I love to talk about too, in the sense of, I want to like get people to be more involved in mission, and I'm like, it's a biblical basis, and then I feel like, well, I'm trying to get people to follow the command of God, but we don't even really follow the command of God to Sabbath so well. So how am I, like, we don't, that doesn't actually work to just tell people this is, like, so we need to get that, like, the Spirit of God to motivate us into mission, but also the Spirit of God to be the motivation for us to live into Sabbath, into the priorities of God, into.
Yeah. I could not agree with you more. I think that a lot of times we act out of, you know, I should be doing this, this or shouldn't. Duty. Yeah. If I do that, it'll be better. I'll be better. Or, you know, but it really just being, you know, breathed and inspired by the Holy Spirit. That's the sweet spot.
Yeah. 100%.
Wow. Yeah. There was so much in that conversation and time. I think I want to just commend, it'll be in the notes for the podcast, his work on Becoming a Friend of Time. That just had so many pieces that we didn't even get to explore in this conversation, but time, the way that time almost enslaves us because we're like, I don't have time to slow down and help somebody who's on the side. I don't have time to help somebody who's in the ditch. I don't have time to help. And it comes back to that whole idea of care and so on, caring for and being cared for. But like time, like my time is worth blah, 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 blah. Like we have all these things that we say, like, and it is a little bit in the sense we are also enslaved into the economy we're in because, my time is value. We put it in those terms, but like we're working for somebody and for some time and all this, and we put it in these ways. We like, nobody's really free. We like to talk about freedom, but we're not really free because we are, we have to work to pay for the life we live and like, but so time, the way we allow time to dictate to us what we can and cannot do is so, interesting. And, and so, like, I'm just getting probably way too abstract, but to what Salma is saying, like, as a student, like this really helps me reflect on like, okay, what am I doing with my time? Am I doing the things that God wants with my time? Or am I doing the things that just are part of the way life is lived anymore.
Yeah, I would say for me, the thing that stood out the most was that sort of final conversation. And I'm grateful that you asked that question. I think that's a very contemporary kind of moment that we're living in right now, and just how we view people and how we view just people, you know, in need and how they're impacting and contributing and that sort of value marker that gets placed on people. And I love that Professor Swinton had such an incredible theological response to that. I think that, you know, we can get caught up in, you know, these sort of, you know,
just fight the fight
cultural moments and we're upset, or we're, you know, it's righteous indignation, or it's confusion, or it's abdication, or these sort of, you know, human responses. And oh man, he really cut that down.
Well, and I was glad that he really helped us come back to the creation story and the narrative of, I mean, there's a lot to unpack in his, like, chapter one of Genesis, have dominion over, like, I'm not disagreeing with what he's saying, but like, we're not supposed to dominate and crush, but that, like, that's sometimes how we take it. But, but the second creation narrative, Genesis 2, has a whole different picture in the way it's describing the way we care for the world, that it's care and I forget the other word he said, but like, so caring for and being cared for are ways that we are human. And then he kind of just allowed that to be the answer to these strange things that people say about people who are needy, or whatever reasons. There's this agenda to solve a problem by eliminating a problem,
right?
Which then infers that the people with that problem are to be eliminated,
right?
Wow. So all of the strange things that people say in the world and have said for a long time about people with disabilities. It's a really great way to sidestep the controversy, or the way to just get mad and fight it. And I think there's a place for activism and to fight for what's right and righteous. But it was a beautiful way to sidestep and just say, bring us back to what God has called us into as humans. What does it mean to be human?
Yeah, that just idea of like caring for others, caring for other. Mm-hmm.
And even in being cared for.
Receiving it, yeah.
I didn't mention it in the conversation, but maybe this is just a good place to put a period or an ellipsis as we draw this to a close is Eva Kitte, who's a philosopher, and she's written on disability, and we can bring some theological reflection to her philosophizing, but she has a daughter with severe disability who needs care for it. But she's making the argument in one of her essays about the caregiver and the cared for, and that we have this sense that somebody is supposed to be cared for to the point of autonomy or independence. Mm-hmm. And she made the point that ultimately having independence is impoverishment.
Like, wow.
So if we're trying to lead people to this place of like, oh, you can be totally independent, that means you don't have any people in your life. And
so there's a need a person.
There's a poverty in that. And so I think that sense of humanness isn't individualized as much as it is humanness in community.
Yeah.
And in the diversity of male and female, and in the diversity of differently, I don't want to say differently able, that's too cliche, but the differently ways that we are embodying our way in this world. And so I think that's just a good way for us to reflect and put an ellipsis as we do this. But that was a wonderful conversation with Professor Swinton, and I'm just glad we could be there for it, and glad you can be there for it as listeners, and keep on keeping up with us. We'll be back with you again soon for another episode of Blind Faith. This has been another episode of Blind Faith. Enjoy having you with us, and come stick around. If you like this one, give us a click like, and whatever platform you're on, give us a rating, and go ahead and subscribe. We're glad you're here with us. We'll be with you again soon.